everybody. Welcome, welcome here to Show 83 on Crypto Voices. Matthew Majinskis, your host from Latvia, joined by my co-host Fernando Ulrich from Brazil.
Hey, Matthew.
And today we are going to introduce our special guest, longtime Bitcoiner, Trace Mayer. Trace is a very longtime Bitcoin advocate, investor, and entrepreneur, well known in the space for being a hodler of last resort, source of great information on the Bitcoin Knowledge podcast, and for 2 years running now, I believe, is promoting the initiative and celebration Proof of Keys, which we're going to talk about a lot today. Very happy to have him on, Trace. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
You're on here now for the second time. A couple years ago, it was during the heated SegWit 2x debate. September 2017 was the last time you were on the show. So lots changed since then. Only bigger and better things for Bitcoin. A lot of stuff to talk about here, but I guess let's just get right into it with Proof of Keys. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of this initiative, of this celebration, as you're calling it.
Oh, I'd be glad to. So there's the website, proofofkeys.com, and Proof of Keys is a celebration of our monetary sovereignty. Bitcoin came out January 3rd, 2009. Satoshi released it. And so every year we celebrate our monetary sovereignty by enforcing it, by claiming it. And we do that by running our own full node so that we validate all the consensus rules, like the 21 million Bitcoin total, and withdrawing all of our crypto, all of our Bitcoin, our Litecoins, everything from any third party to that node that we're running. And that way we claim our monetary sovereignty, we prove the keys are there and that we hold them ourselves individually. You know, each individual is doing it. And we get to learn a lot in the process, and we get to educate new people that are coming into the space on how to do this and why to do this and everything. And just it gets to be a lot of fun, you know, because we have hats now with honey badgers like running off with the keys in their mouth. And, you know, we just get to have a lot of fun with it, and we get to build a lot of camaraderie. And, you know, the monetary sovereignty, the technology has gotten it there, but it's going to take the political will to keep it there. And this is a way that we can strengthen the decentralized and censorship-resistant properties of the Bitcoin network by decentralizing all of these keys to everybody who's willing and able to claim their monetary sovereignty.
And who are you trying to help with this initiative then? Who is the focus group here?
Well, everybody, you know, everybody in the world, because having your monetary sovereignty is just critical. It's important. You know, look at all these protesters in Hong Kong. They're being oppressed by totalitarian government. And how does that totalitarian government get its funding? By infringing their monetary sovereignty. So isn't that ironic that they're paying the salaries of their oppressors? Because it's being siphoned off through the financial and monetary system. If they were able to claim their monetary sovereignty, it would sure, you know, it's going to do a whole lot more to change things than, you know, picking up a couple cans of tear gas is doing.
You are a notable investor in Kraken. And so my question here is, are the exchanges perhaps getting annoyed with your monetary sovereignty-ness all the time?
Well, I don't really care, even if I'm an investor, and I own a very large stake in Kraken. And you know what? Kraken better be able to perform on Proof of Keys. Otherwise, you know, they become a massive embarrassment. You know, they were formed because we didn't want to have another Mt. Gox. In last year, Quadriga CX, Cryptopia, they both failed and went into liquidation with bankruptcy trustees after Proof of Keys happened. So, you know, I don't really care what these exchanges or lending services or whoever's the third party holding the keys, I don't really care. Like, when you're the monetary sovereign, like, you're the king or the queen. Well, not these services that are just your valet driver. Like, if you ask for your car from the valet driver, they better give it to you. And if they don't give it to you, then and the valet driver shouldn't be annoyed because you asked for your car. That's their job. is to go get the car and give it to you. And so, you know, that's what, you know, this is about, because, okay, the valet driver might hold the keys to the car. And so they get to determine whether or not they're going to actually go get the car and give it to you or not. But, you know, that's why you need to assert your monetary sovereignty and claim it, is to prove that they're going to go get the car and give it to you. You know, and we can do it every year, and we can help train and teach and educate new people on how to safely engage in the process and why they should. And all of, you know, all of us can grow this spine of monetary sovereignty. And we really shouldn't be concerned with what our servants, you know, and that's what these exchanges and these other institutions and organizations are. They're our servants that are custodying and taking care of our keys for us so that we can trade or whatever. But they're not the king or the queen. You are. And you have to assert your monetary sovereignty and prove that. You need to prove that you've got the keys. So, you know, if they're annoyed, like, they need to get over that real quick. And Jesse, you know, over at Kraken, he's a big supporter of proof of keys. And he actually recommends people not keep on the exchange any more than they really need to in order to do the trading that they want to do. He doesn't want to be custodying extra assets that aren't being used for the trading. And there are multiple reasons for that. I mean, Kraken, they, you know, it's expensive to custody these assets and stuff, like, and you don't really earn revenue from doing that part of the business. So it's an expense, but you don't really earn revenue. So, you know, that's one reason Kraken doesn't want to be custodying assets if they aren't being actively used for the trading. And I think that's a great stance. And then he also, you know, is a fan of proof of keys and the monetary sovereignty. So that's also a very good thing. You know, because this is the type of an audit that you can't fake. Like, if you ask for your Bitcoin and they don't send it to you, they failed. If they send it to you, they passed. Like, it's very binary, and you can't fake it because that Bitcoin's limited in amount.
Obviously, Jesse's another star in the space. Like you mentioned, trading and exchanging Bitcoin the right way. But like you said, too often institutions, exchanges, banks today, brokerages today, they just, you know, it's topsy-turvy, it's upside down the way that your wealth, your assets are looked at. Since we do have this amazing opportunity with Bitcoin to just constantly do this audit, like you said, we just can constantly post to the world this many Bitcoin is moving around on the chain on January 3rd. What would you like to see actually happen as a result of this initiative, specifically on January 3rd?
Oh, well, I want to see individuals just get the confidence that comes from being the monetary sovereign, you know, wearing the Bitcoin crown, right? Because gold is the ancient metal of kings. And there's a certain, when you're holding a big pile of gold in your hand that you own outright, you know, there's a particular feeling that comes with that type of sovereignty, having that type of power. And you get the same type of thing with Bitcoin, you know, when you're holding those keys, because you know that you're in control of it, not someone else. And so, you know, I want everybody to be in control of their own money and in control of their own wealth. And I don't want other people telling them what they need to do and telling them, you know, that they can't have their Bitcoin because of XYZ. You know, maybe there's a withdrawal limit. Maybe there's like a AML KYC imposed thing that they're, or maybe they're trying to blame it on that so that they don't have an outflow of the assets because they're running fractional reserve and it's some type of Ponzi scam. You know, we've seen plenty of those in this space. Mt. Gox, Quadriga CX, Cryptopia, and who knows how many other thousands of exchanges have failed. Just this year, we had Einstein Exchange up in Canada failed, another $20 million of customer funds lost. I want people to not be losing their hard-earned savings. But, you know, everybody's got to claim their monetary sovereignty. They can't be lazy. They can't be ignorant. They got to put in the work. You just got to do it. And, you know, so I'd like people taking that initiative. And it also helps me You know, because then the Bitcoin network as a whole is more decentralized and more secure and more censorship resistant and more distributed. And that helps everybody. So not only do you get to help yourself in a lot of these ways, you know, gaining the technological skill and competence, getting that feeling of having your monetary sovereignty, but you also get to participate with everybody else in strengthening the Bitcoin network, you know, by running full nodes that are being used for economically substantive transactions. So, you know, this is really a great opportunity for all of us Bitcoiners to come together and you know, just give the Bitcoin network a big shot in the arm of monetary sovereignty power.
I know that you're a fan running your own node and doing it yourself, taking responsibilities you just mentioned, but you're not so much a fan of some of the tools that are offered, I believe, because of the various risks. Can you elaborate on some of those? For example, like, you know, you have different classes of Bitcoin citizens is one way you describe it. But, you know, we have some tools like, you know, a Ledger or a Trezor, which give you control of your keys, but not necessarily control of your coins. At the end of the day, there may not be any coins there, even though you control your keys. So there's a couple different levels people need to be educated about. What are your thoughts on this true monetary sovereignty? What do people really need to do to be in control?
Yeah, so to be a first-class Bitcoin citizen, to be full-fledged, like fully vetted, you need to be running your own full node, and that's where you're performing all the consensus validation, you know, so that you know that the Bitcoins are Bitcoins, and you're not relying on somebody else to tell you that the Bitcoin's a Bitcoin. And there are a lot of privacy implications with that, by the way. And the second one is to hold your own private keys. And so, you know, you do those two things. And on proofofkeys.com, we have a little, you know, we have several guides. One's the Glacier Protocol guide. Another is a smart custody guide that Christopher Allen has put together with a lot of other people. And so, you know, those can help walk you through some of the basics and gain some of that education and understanding about what's going on. But that's how you become a first-class Bitcoin citizen. You run your own full node and do all your own full validation of the consensus rules, and you hold your own private keys. And, you know, running that full node, your own full node, I like the Bitcoin Core software. That's the backbone of the Bitcoin network, you know, 90-something percent of the network is running that software. And it also has a wallet built into it, but I really like Armory for managing the private keys because you get a lot more flexibility. You can do a lot more things in Armory that you just can't really do with Bitcoin Core. Armory's more of like a Swiss Army knife. And Armory runs on top of the Bitcoin Core for the network consensus validation. So you get all the power that comes from Bitcoin Core for validating your transactions, and then you just manage the private keys with Armory. And I like that. I like using something like Armory and Bitcoin Core versus special purpose Bitcoin specific hardware. You know, not that like a Casa node or a Trezor or any of this, you know, I'm not trying to disparage them at all or anything, but everybody, like, you know that that stuff's being used for Bitcoin. So when you buy that off of Amazon, like 5 years down the road, if somebody's like, I want a list of all the people who are involved in Bitcoin, and they search everybody who's bought Trezors, like, you show up on that list with your address where it was shipped to. And then, like, when you're running the Trezor or the Ledger, you're connecting to their server, most likely, in order to figure out what the balances are on your Bitcoins. And their server could lie to you, by the way. That's why you want to run your own full node. But you're also leaking a bunch of data and information to them. Your IP address, the addresses that you're checking balances on. You know, now they know
all prior and all future addresses.
Right, all prior and all future addresses. You know, assuming that their software and hardware is good and not malicious, you know, because maybe they're just waiting for a certain amount of Bitcoin to get in the addresses, and then they're just going to steal them all because they've compromised the software. I mean, have you reviewed the code? Like, who's reviewed their code? I haven't really looked at it because I don't use those. But I know that Bitcoin Core and Armory have had a lot of eyeballs looking at it, and that it's considered safe by a lot of experts in the field. And you know, so there's that, and then there's also like just having all that data or information at Ledger or Trezor or these other hardware wallets, that becomes a massive honeypot or a massive like trove for nefarious hackers to try and get access to, because you know they get access to that and get emails and IP addresses and all this stuff, and now they can like figure out where to go target to try and you know get large batches of Bitcoin. So you know that's one of the reasons I don't like the special purpose Bitcoin hardware, or because I'd just rather be using general purpose computers that nobody knows that, like the reason that computer got bought was to do Bitcoin stuff. Like nobody knows that, right? Because it's just a general purpose computer that was bought versus, you know, buying something that's specifically a Bitcoin wallet. So that's kind of my beef or grudge against some of the specific stuff. Not that it's bad, not that, you know, and it's probably fine to use for smaller amounts of coins and stuff, and it's also good to use it just to be competent in like the different types of tech that's out there. But if you want to be serious, you know, Bitcoin Core, Armory, those are serious solutions. You know, and even running your Bitcoin Core on a computer that doesn't touch the internet and uses a satellite, like that's even better, right?
That's the hardcore way.
Yeah, I mean, then your ISP doesn't even know that you're running a full node because that type of traffic's not coming in and out of your connection, right? And you know, just what data are you leaking? You know that, and privacy is a continuum. You don't need to, you know, you don't need to be absolutely perfect in all of that area, but it's also kind of fun just to tinker with it and see what you're able to do. And why not learn something new, and why not get better instead of just staying the same or getting stagnant? You know, keep growing and progressing in your ability to interact with these tools. And because that knowledge is power, and you invest in yourself, you're going to, you know, that's the best investment you can be making is in yourself.
But there's also a continuum in security and convenience. I mean, there's a trade-off in security and convenience. So how would you segregate, or how much would you allocate of your Bitcoins for the full node running an Armory on top of a full node? And how much would you perhaps allocate on just a smartphone wallet? Or how would you do this? How can you manage convenience and security on a daily or weekly basis?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely an individual choice and value proposition that everybody's got to take into account for themselves. But I think that being ignorant on the different solutions that are out there is very, very costly because you don't know what you can do. If you're storing $100 of Bitcoin, like put $100 of thought into it. But if you're storing tens of thousands of dollars of Bitcoin or millions of dollars of Bitcoin, like put the equivalent amount of thought into doing that and effort, you know. And I, you know, I coined the term hardware of last resort. So you don't necessarily need to be doing this on a daily or weekly basis. I mean, you set up your cold storage properly, and then you just there. Like, why do you ever need to touch the cold storage, right? Because that's the whole point of it. You're like, you bought it to hold it indefinitely, and so you don't need to be moving stuff around. But I also like proof of keys because you can do that once a year just to, you know, dust off your cold storage, brush up on your current best practices, make sure that all your backups are working and things like that, making sure that you don't have key like coins sitting on different exchange accounts or wherever that you might have forgotten about. You do that type of spring cleaning once a year. And what better time than the first of the year, right? January 3rd. Like what better time to do it? Then you're not, the chances of losing your Bitcoins or losing track of them or forgetting about them goes down because you know, January 3rd, you're going around everywhere, like just trying to find stuff that you might have forgotten about, just checking all those exchange accounts. And Peter McCormick, from What Bitcoin Did podcast, he actually credits me with saving him half a Bitcoin because he had totally forgotten about it on Cryptopia. And because of proof of keys, he went and looked around and, oh, I forgot my half a Bitcoin there. So he withdrew it. And then, you know, a short time later, Cryptopia failed and went into receivership. And he would have totally lost that half a Bitcoin that he had forgotten about had he not participated in proof of keys. So, you know, that's another important thing to do is, you know, just be looking around.
Let's look into some of the ways that Bitcoiners can signal for this. Obviously, you have the proof of keys signal on Twitter. I actually don't normally signal stuff on Twitter, but I did do it for you because I think it's very, very important. Change the Crypto Voices handle for signaling proof of keys on January 3rd. Other Bitcoiners could do that. But what else, again, would you like to see happen on the 3rd? Are you hoping for a spike then in on-chain volumes? I understand that last year was sort of the first year that you did this. Any learnings from last year on what you want to see happen this year?
Yeah, so last year, Andreas Antonopoulos, actually, he was kind of, I don't know if this is the best idea. It might be too successful and crash the entire industry. In which case, I was like, well, like we shouldn't be running fractional reserve exchanges and stuff across the industry. Like, you know, that's if that's how this industry is operating, like that needs to go away. that type of bad behavior. And we actually saw it go away with Quadriga CX and Cryptopia with their failures. So, you know, that's on the macro side of, you know, things that I like to see are the bad actors getting weeded out. But really, this is an individual thing. And so I like to see people being able to claim their monetary sovereignty, getting the confidence and the power that comes from doing that, you know, holding their own money and being in control of it. You know, that's what I like seeing. I like seeing the social action that's going on, you know, changing the Twitter handles, adding that January 3rd with the key and the lock and the proof sign. You know, that shows solidarity in our purpose, why we're involved in Bitcoin. I mean, are we just trying to make a buck or are we trying to change the world? You know, and the most powerful way you can change the world is by changing the money and bringing sound money back. That's what made America great. You know, you want to make America great again, like it's sound money and freedom of speech. And it's not just the United States, it's this concept of America. And so no matter what country you're in, you can bring this concept of America to you by claiming your monetary sovereignty. You know, why go out and get in some protest in Hong Kong or France or Venezuela or wherever? Just vote no confidence in the money and dissolve those monetary bands by proving the keys. You know, that's how you can really begin affecting change. And so I like seeing that. I like seeing all the Twitter comments and YouTube comments and everybody, you know, just stirring up the discussion and helping the new people who are in the space who need that education and understanding and all of those types of things. Like they need that help because they're brand new into it. Like who else is going to help them? When are they going to help them? And a lot of these new people, they don't even know what they need help with. So just by having the interviews and having the podcasts and having the YouTube shows and all of this discussion, we help people become aware of this vitally important subject of running full nodes and holding your own private keys. And so I like seeing that also, you know, and that helps strengthen the decentralization, the censorship resistant properties of the Bitcoin network. And it helps further infuse that ethos that Bitcoiners have or should have, you know, what we're in this for. We're in this for our monetary sovereignty. We're in this because we want to be kings and queens of our own money, not being told what we can and can't do by some third party bureaucrat stamp pushing slug, right? That says, oh, you can't withdraw your money because I don't feel like it today. and they put a denied stamp on your withdrawal. You know, none of that. Like, you get to prove the keys, you get to be in control of it. And you learn a lot when people do or do not send you your Bitcoin. If you ask for it and they don't send it to you, boy, you just learned a lot from that process.
I want to look at a tweet that you suggested on 4th of November. You mentioned perhaps the possibility of a proof of keys coin. I know you're not a huge fan of altcoins, but did you get any good responses to that tweet? And do you think you might develop that at all?
You know, I don't think I'd make a coin or anything. But, you know, some people like the idea. Some people didn't like the idea. I like the idea because, you know, you create that coin, it can impose an additional burden on the exchanges that don't provide that coin to people. Especially if that coin were to have, let's say we were using that coin as a test bed for some feature that we wanted to roll out, like Mimblewimble. You know, that's where I could see it being particularly useful or helpful is, you know, it's almost like a test net, but maybe it'll get a little bit of economic value. And, you know, and then when that happens, it can exert a little bit of pressure on the third parties to support it or whatever. But, you know, mostly the altcoins, I see them just as a distraction. So that's just an initial idea. You know, how can we financially incentivize people to participate in proof of keys? And I could see, you know, something like that being a way to do it. But, you know, maybe I think at this stage where we're at, it'd be too much work and not enough return. So, you know, it's one of those ideas that, you know, put it on the back burner and go focus on something that's a little more actionable and practical right now.
I want to make some comparisons with gold a little bit, because I think it's fascinating. Fernando and I are hard money Austrians, fans of gold for a long time, you know, fans of monetary history for a long time, as I know that you are. I think there's a lot of interesting parallels we can draw between what we can and can't do with gold and what we can and can't do with Bitcoin. I want to throw a couple stats out at you first and see where you might take this. So many investors, like Jim Turk, founder of Gold Money, who I know that you have invested in the past, they've always been very hard-nosed about making sure your gold is allocated, your gold is under your name, and, you know, ready for you to at least have audited and withdraw if you choose, or take delivery, as they say, if you choose. Now, the gold markets, particularly in London, are very, very murky. I want to run, as I mentioned, I want to run a few numbers here for our listeners. We cover some of this in our quarterly monetary base updates. So all the gold ever mined in the history of the world is roughly 6 billion ounces. 6 billion ounces is $9 trillion. Central banks apparently hold 18% of this, or 1.1 billion ounces. And let's assume that the bullion banks, the major banks, the market makers in London, the US, around the world, they make up the rest all the way up to jewelry. Gold is not like a blockchain, no one knows for sure. Roughly 50% of gold demand today is jewelry. Let's say 50% of the stock is as well. So this is a very, very conservative estimate. It's not that high, but let's just say institutions, bullion banks, they hold 3 billion ounces of gold. So half of all the gold ever mined. Now, hard money researchers like Bullion Star, who I read quite a bit, they estimate that the London bullion banks alone trade 50 billion ounces of gold traded a year. In London alone, it's probably much more. And then the actual gold that comes out of the ground is only 100 million ounces a year. So we talk about this paper gold versus physical gold. The calculation that I just did, which again, I would say is very, very conservative, that would be 500 to 1. So paper gold traded each year is 500 to 1 over the physical gold. Now, many of these resources, I'm sure you've read them, they claim that that number is much, much higher. You know, thousands of multiples paper gold over physical gold. There's no way to verify this, but it's probably true. But my question regarding gold, before we get back to Bitcoin, my question regarding gold, it seems like that's not necessarily a sustainable number if you have thousands of, a multiple of 1,000 or more, 500 or more paper gold traded over physical gold. Why don't you think more attention has been brought to that in the likes of, you know, people like Jim Turk, Gold Money? They're doing it the right way, but it still seems that, you know, the average person doesn't really care. What do you make of that?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. First, just because the trading volume numbers are really high, that doesn't necessarily mean there's the paper. I mean, look at the Bitcoin volume numbers, like $60 to $100 billion a day of volume and $130 billion of market cap. So, I mean, that's kind of normal in that sense. The stock to flow ratio, now that's where things start getting very exciting because, if you've read Saifedean's book, The Bitcoin Standard, and gold, you know, is that superior monetary technology that has that very high stock to flow ratio, where you're taking the current stock, which is the price times the number of ounces, and that gives you the stock, and then you take the flow, which is the number of new ounces per year, and the higher that ratio, the better. And Bitcoin's actually going to have a stock to flow ratio close to gold's after the halving in about 150 days. So, you know, that starts getting very interesting. Now, I've been a consultant to GATA, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, for, gosh, about 10 years now. And I was one of the top seven shareholders of Gold Money. I mean, I own a pretty big percentage of Gold Money. And I was an investor in Gold Money before Bitcoin even existed. Why was I so interested in Gold Money? Well, you know, in the mid 90s, I was interested in e-gold, you know, which was sound money. And I was interested in the peer-to-peer networks, you know, like LimeWire and Kazaa and BitTorrent and virtual currencies. I was interested in that stuff too. And so Gold Money, you know, they were trying to do it the regulated way. E-Gold was doing it the non-regulated way. E-Gold's founder has an ankle bracelet on. Gold Money, you know, they're doing it the regulated way, following AML KYC laws and stuff like that, and they're still around. I've since divested myself of my Gold Money position when they did the reverse merger with Royce Sabag and the TSX Venture and stuff, just because I'm so much more focused on Bitcoin stuff now than gold money. So, and the reason is because I see Bitcoin being able to do what gold does, but doing it in an even more superior of a way. And what do I mean by that? We have scarcity enforced via the consensus rules with Bitcoin. And the cost to run a full node is very low. You can just download it and run it on your computer for free, you know, Bitcoin Core. And that's one thing we should be doing during proof of keys. Now, with gold money and with gold, because it exists in one place in space and time, because it's an atom, you know, Bitcoin, you can have multiple seed backups in multiple different places. You can even split it up with fragmented backups and Shamir secret sharing using Armory. You can't do that with gold, right? It's got to be in one place at one time. And just ask the Incas how that turned out for them, right? And so, that's one of the weaknesses to gold is that it's more prone to censorship. And because it's more prone to censorship, it's prone to economic censorship. And that's what has happened with the gold price suppression scheme. Because anybody who's been exposed to the evidence and continues to dispute the gold price suppression scheme, they're either in denial or they're complicit. Like, the case has been pretty much cracked for at least the last 14 or 15 years. And what's happening with the gold price suppression scheme is that central banks carry gold in the vault and gold out on loan as the same line item. In effect, they're reporting cash and accounts receivable as the same thing. And they lease the physical gold to the bullion banks who suppress the price through all of the gold leases and the gold swaps and this paper gold supply. And then when you get into the actual physical markets, it's very murky. You know, when Turk started Gold Money, you know, it is a very simple business model. We're going to know exactly how every 1 ounce of gold in the Gold Money vault, it will equal 1 ounce in the Gold Money database. And then there's a whole process with trusts and different people that sign off in order to create those database entries, and then every ounce is audited and stuff like that. Well, you know, we have to, in order to carry out that vision, you have to have the physical gold in allocated storage. And so it was very simple. Like, Gold Money wanted to buy LBMA bars, London Good Delivery bars, and put them in their own cage. So, you know, in the gold vault in London, they wanted to have their own cage with their own little lock on it. And when they wired money to the bullion bank, you know, Scotia or JP Morgan or whoever, then they would take the physical bar and put it in their cage and then lock their cage. And then they would have their own little cage with their gold bar in it in the vault. Well, guess what? None of the bullion banks would sell them gold bars that they could take possession of. They would sell them gold bars, but they wouldn't let them take possession of it into their own cage, even in the same vault, even when they paid cash on the barrelhead for the bar. That's just wild, isn't it? And so, you know what Gold Money actually had to do in order to get LBMA, LGD bars into their cage? We had to leverage a relationship with one of the board members who had a big ownership stake in a gold mining company to buy the supply of gold that came directly out of the refiner. I mean, like, that was wild. And what I think this highlights is it highlights the cost to run a gold full node. The cost is really high. You basically have to have a refinery, right? And so when Poland like took 100 tons of their gold, took possession of it, they had to, from London, they had to get a whole bunch of armored cars and police and security companies all involved in moving and transporting that gold. And they just moved it. They didn't actually melt it down and recast it to verify or to assay the quantity and the quality of it. And how much money did it cost for them to move that 100 tons of gold? You know, and how much money did it cost Germany to bring 850 tons of gold back from the New York Fed to Germany? You know, that's very expensive. Bitcoin, like last week, somebody moved $330 million of Bitcoin for 32 cents. And that transaction verifies the quantity and the quality with 100%. You know, so it's like totally melting down and recasting the gold bar and teleporting it wherever you want in the world. Right. So the cost to run a gold full node is just so high compared to the cost to run a Bitcoin full node. And we ran into these problems at Gold Money, you know, when we're first starting to start the company, with being able to actually hold our own keys to the gold, you know, to hold the physical bar ourselves. They would sell us the bar, but they wouldn't let us take possession of it. And so we don't necessarily know whose is what down there in the vault in London and in Switzerland. And the Chinese and the Russians, you know what they're doing? They're buying the gold. They're taking possession of it, and then they're melting it down in Singapore and recasting it into new bars and then flying it to Beijing. And you know, I think part of that is because they want to remove any potential strings that might be attached to those particular bars because of the serial numbers. And, you know, so this is a very interesting area. I mean, I got all types of war scars, you know, war scars and war stories from being involved in this fight for monetary sovereignty over the last couple decades. And it's really interesting and it's really fun. And Bitcoin just is such a powerful tool that we can bring to this battle, and proof of keys is a way that we can all of us individually participate and arm ourselves with the most powerful tools possible that are out there.
You mentioned the gold's price suppression that has occurred over the years. I mean, and if anybody who has looked on, has researched about the history of the London gold fix, I mean, it's abysmal. It's incredible what has been going on for decades, even to this day. But it's not only gold, it's even the LIBOR scandal. So that has happened even with interest rates. Now, my question to you is, when we analyze the same, let's say, issue, the discovery of price of a Bitcoin, we know we're not in a place only of saints, and we have problems with exchanges. There has been some problems in terms of fake volumes. So what is your current assessment of the price discovery of Bitcoin at the moment?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And I'd preface it with, you know, why it's very strange behavior. If you own a lot of something, why run a cartel to keep the price down? You know, a price is being suppressed, not supported, and not by users, but by owners, and not for the obvious reasons. And it's because their ability to issue what we use as currency is infinitely more valuable than the price of a portfolio asset. And by suppressing that price, they're able to suppress interest rates, you know, because gold is like the thermometer. Just like a fever tells you something is wrong with the body, the rising price of gold tells you there's something wrong with the fiat monetary system. And so there's two primary purposes that they engage in the gold price suppression scheme. One is the suppression of evidence. They're trying to remove our ability to perform accurate economic calculation. And two is to throttle monetary innovation and evolution, you know, which is why they stomped all over e-gold and you know, have made it very difficult on Bitcoin companies and anybody who's trying to innovate in the space, because they want to protect their obsolete, ancient, archaic fiat fractional reserve system. But, you know, technology just, it powers ahead. You know, the Stone Age didn't end because of a lack of stones. And so, you know, that's what's happening is Bitcoin, because, you know, we're talking about censorship resistance. And gold, because it lacked these properties that Bitcoin has, the cost to run a full node is high. It's not provably scarce. You know, we know exactly how many Bitcoins there are. Gold, we're kind of approximating or guessing. You know, it lacked some of these characteristics that Bitcoin has. And so with, you know, and then gold, there's already a very large stock, right? There's a lot of value stored in it. So, but with Bitcoin, it started from scratch. When I started publicly recommending and talking about Bitcoin, it had less than $1 million market cap. You know, Bitcoin was tiny. It was nothing. And so as we're looking at price discovery, and then we add in these additional characteristics where you can demand the private keys yourself, there's only so much price suppression that can happen, because when they create paper gold in that's trading in conjunction with the physical gold, because the cost to run a full gold node is very high, it discourages people from proving the quantity and the quality of their gold and taking possession of it, right? Like doing a proof of keys in the gold industry is very expensive, but in Bitcoin it only costs you a couple cents for a transaction fee, right? So like they run into this problem. Bitcoin, because it has these more powerful censorship resistant characteristics, it makes it much more difficult to engage in economic censorship of the interest rate and of the pricing of Bitcoin. And when you have paper Bitcoin and real Bitcoin, and you're trying to enforce an exchange rate peg between the two of them by suppressing the price of the real Bitcoin, so that you're able to have it trading at par with the paper Bitcoin, well, eventually that exchange rate's going to fail. Why? Because people are going to, you know, savvy people are going to be like, hey, everything else being equal, give me the real Bitcoin if it's at the same price as the paper Bitcoin, right? And so you demand possession of the real Bitcoins with something like proof of keys, and then a bunch of paper Bitcoin just evaporates into nothing. Mt. Gox, Quadriga CX, Cryptopia. There are a lot of people who thought they had Bitcoin, when really they had paper Bitcoin on those institutions and exchanges. And so that's the same type of problem that people who might try to suppress the price of Bitcoin will run into, is savvy people that understand what's going on are going to be like, hey, thanks for keeping the price low. Give me the real Bitcoin. And then they're going to run off with it. You know, that's why honey badger's our mascot, because it eats snakes and it runs off with whatever, you know, it runs off with the snake that it's eating. So, you know, this is very important point for people to understand, is like, if there's some large attempt to suppress the price of Bitcoin, like, be happy and grateful for that, because you're able to acquire more Bitcoin at a lower price, because there's this false equivalency between paper Bitcoin and real Bitcoin, which is where the temporary price suppression is happening. And so just buy the real Bitcoin and demand possession of it. And then you get the real Bitcoin at a lower price than you otherwise would have had to pay. And if you're a hodler of last resort, you want to buy it as cheap as you can. You know, you want the most number of Satoshis that you can get. So we actually, you know, it's kind of nice if they suppress the price of gold, suppress the price of Bitcoin, because it acts as a wealth transfer to the people who buy and take possession of the real Bitcoin.
I love these conversations. This is, I think this is the heart of what a lot of our interest is around both gold and Bitcoin. One statement and then a question. The statement is, you mentioned the Bank of Poland. I don't know if you've read about their history of gold, you know, from World War II on, but the Polish gold was an incredible story. You know, the first month when Hitler invaded Poland in 1939, the war was on. That month, literally, they were taking it in unmarked buses. It was about 100 tons, you know, compare that to, say, France had 2,000 tons. But they were taking that gold in unmarked buses down out of Poland, through Ukraine, through Romania, got it on a boat in the Black Sea, stopped in Istanbul, then got it on a train. Somehow the Turks, who were sort of neutral in World War II, let them get it on a train. And then it went down to Lebanon and was taken in a French carrier over to France, to where it was then taken to Africa and then to New York. And then all the way back, as you just said, trying to get in armored cars out of London not so long ago. The point is that gold has shown to be obviously a linchpin for, first of all, it was relatively easily centralized, specifically during World War II and from Hitler. I think there was something like 30% of all the world's gold was in the U.S. before World War II, and after World War II, it was over 70% of monetary official gold. So that's a point right there that shows that is one weakness with gold. But then as well, who really owns that Polish gold, right? I mean, is it really the Polish people? Is it one central banker that, you know, sits on the French carrier that takes it away? You know, what does the captain have to say? If you really dig into the mechanics of, as you say, running your own gold full node, it's incredibly expensive and it is very easily centralized. So just want to point that out for our listeners if they haven't heard that. I love the story about the Polish gold. It's just a good example of how difficult it is to keep security of your gold. But then a follow-up to that, with everything else you've been saying, which I still think it's a fascinating thing to compare with Bitcoin there, is what you said about paper gold versus paper Bitcoin. So whatever it is, you know, bullion star, many of these people, I say 500 to one, they might say 15,000 to one. No one really knows. It's murky and the price has been suppressed, as you say. Do you think they're going to try to do that with Bitcoin? Do you think they're going to try to, whether it be through regulation, do you think they're going to try to control a lot of the Bitcoin and then eventually through some derivative futures, whatever, maybe try to suppress the price?
It was an absolutely stunning, blatant admission by Giancarlo, the CFTC commissioner, that they approved the CME cash-settled futures because they wanted to pop the Bitcoin bubble, pop the Bitcoin price. And, I mean, it was gonna happen on its own because it was unsustainable. But that they, like, felt that they needed to approve CME cash-settled futures to kind of help with the process, I found to be very interesting. Now, even if they tried to engage in a Bitcoin price suppression scheme, the problem they've got is that they are not hodlers of last resort. they don't have the ultimate collateral. You know, like what are they going to do? Look at Bakkt, for example. They've got cash settled futures in Singapore. Now it's coming out that even though they're supposed to be physically settled, they only have 37% or something like that. We don't know exactly how their warehouse works. When you look at the plunge protection team and the president's working group on financial markets,
yep,
and the gold price suppression scheme. And keep in mind, Alan Greenspan testified twice before Congress that central banks, plural,
yep,
stand ready to lease gold in increasing quantities should the price rise. Well, where do they actually execute the gold price suppression scheme? COMEX, CME, ICE. Now all the markets are just manipulations. There's not really any free markets out there except Bitcoin. And the problem they've got with Bitcoin is that they don't have the ultimate collateral. And so, like, let's say that they do try to suppress it, and there are a bunch of short positions that are out there. Well, what happens if some hodler of last resort moves on 200,000 Bitcoin and decides to go 10x leverage on BitMEX and pull down 2 million of physical Bitcoin and margin call the entire space that's trying to be short? But remember, when you naked short something, you have unlimited upside potential loss. So, I mean, like, they don't own the actual underlying collateral. And I think that's one of the big problems they've got if they try to engage in a Bitcoin price suppression scheme, is they've got these hodlers of last resort that can always come in and completely obliterate the paper shorts. Oh, I can mention a little bit more about World War II and the gold if you want.
I think that's a fascinating topic. Fascinating.
Yeah, so World War II, it was so fascinating how the Third Reich used the exchange rate mechanisms and the gold to conscript the economic resources to power their war engine. And it just shows and highlights the importance of people claiming and asserting their monetary sovereignty, because it helps protect against these despotic inroads on the part of government. And paper currency and fractional reserve and hypothecation, and now hyper-hypothecation and hyper-rehypothecation, just look at the repo markets, it's a way that the current system is conscripting so many resources from people and putting at risk hundreds of millions of lifetimes worth of value that are in pension funds and everything in order to fund their misadventures and misallocate the capital. And sound money is going to bring back such a tremendous amount of discipline in order to this planet that, you know, it tried to assert during World War II. And that's why a lot of the gold flowed to the U.S. And it's one of the primary reasons that the U.S. was able to be so strong and win World War II, is because they had these economic resources that were built on a solid monetary foundation of gold, even after what Roosevelt had done. You know, it still had the remnants of the power that comes from sound money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can throw one stat at you as well. We've started to compile. I want to keep building this up. It's a bit shaky from the 60s and 70s, but that percentage of the gold that central banks held in those days, you know, pre-De Gaulle, going and claiming the gold on the U.S., 60s, 50s, 60s, that was probably 40, 50, 60% of the actual monetary base globally, like the actual amount of currency that they were printing, the central bank balance sheet. And it even went as high as, I think, 85% in 1980. And then with all of these things that you're talking about, suppression, paper gold, and basically being very murky about who owns what gold, even if we look at the official gold reserves, which they probably don't have those, but even if we look at the official, if you can imagine a chart from 1980 as a percentage, gold versus the monetary base versus the money they print, it's gone from like 80, 85% down and down and down and down to today it's less than 7%. And so basically, as the monetary base, which we publish that every quarter, You know, that's $19 trillion equivalent from the top 30 floating currencies in the world, their monetary base. The actual gold that they hold, and they probably don't even hold it, as you've mentioned, is less than 7% of that.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book, The Great Credit Contraction, released it the same week that Satoshi released Bitcoin, right? Like, at all times and in all circumstances, gold remains money, the most important money in the world. But now Bitcoin's out there, you know, and it's going to have a stock-to-flow ratio similar to gold's, and yet it's extensible and has superior censorship-resistant qualities. And so that's the multi-trillion dollar question is it going to be the U.S. dollar? Is it going to be gold? Or is it going to be something else? Is it going to be Bitcoin? And during this great credit contraction, the capital burrows down the liquidity pyramid into safer and more liquid assets. So, you know, that's where it's going. It's going into treasury bills and it's going into gold and it's going into Bitcoin. And the last layer of this hyper deflation and credit contraction that's happening will be hyperinflation, because those paper illusions that circulate as currency, fiat currencies, they're going to evaporate into nothing because they can become worthless. But gold and Bitcoin, they're equity based and they're limited in amount by their intrinsic characteristics of atoms or cryptography. And so they can never become worthless. You know, gold's never become worthless in its history, and neither has Bitcoin. And so when you're burrowed and ensconced as a hodler of last resort in this ultimate form of monetary technology that enables you to acquire protection at the lowest possible cost out there, you know, because with the Bitcoin, you're protected against confiscation through inflation because you can't just create more of the Bitcoin. It's strictly scarce under the protocol rules, right? So you're able to protect yourself from that, and you're able to protect yourself against third-party, counterparty risk, performance risk, all of that stuff, because you're running your own full node, you're holding your own private keys, proof of keys. That's why this stuff is so important to help maintain the decentralized, censorship-resistant characteristics of the Bitcoin network by having all of these individual, small, economically substantive transactions happening on January 3rd, you know, draining all the Bitcoin out of these third parties, you know, proving the keys are with the people who own them and have said, send them to me. You know, so it's, this is how we deal with this great credit contraction. And if you're in the lifeboat, if you're ensconced in the protection, you don't really care about what happens out there. In fact, all the better the sooner it collapses, because then we can get to having a more accurate tool and economy for doing economic calculation and distributing and employing the factors of production to serve consumer needs and wants.
And then I would also maybe caution, or want to get your thoughts from, you know, our age, older, many, many people who are hard money, gold and silver bugs, whatever the case may be, before Bitcoin ever came up, you know, try to promote this idea of monetary sovereignty and sound money with gold, particularly for years and years and years. It hasn't necessarily happened. I would say it probably hasn't happened at all. There's definitely the paper gold problem, as we've talked about, price suppression problem, as we talked about. So if we bring it to Bitcoin now, we actually have some of these opportunities, all of these good features of Bitcoin that you mentioned. I don't want to have you make a hard and fast prediction here, but do you think it's going to be a big blow and a crisis as we move to a new monetary order? Or do you think it'll be another sort of slow bleed as people sort of realize that this truly sound money in the digital world is out there?
Yeah, I mean, sound money, it needs to be embraced one by one by each individual. And, you know, that's what we see happening with Bitcoin. And I think one of the reasons is, you know, when the current system is not too bad and the cost to claim your monetary sovereignty is pretty high, you know, running a gold full node, opportunity costs, all those things, there isn't really the demand for it. But as you lower the cost and you increase the reasons that people would demand it, trillions of dollars in negative yielding debt, retail customers getting negative interest rates in German banks,
yep.
you know, bailouts, bail-ins, financial crisis all over the place. You know, that gives further incentive for people to be like, you know what, I want to claim a little bit of my monetary sovereignty. And so it happens one by one, and the lower the cost to claim your monetary sovereignty, and the worse the alternatives get, the more, you know, I think we see people coming into it. And that's exactly what we've seen with Bitcoin. You know, it's grown every year, the number of people in the space, the number of people using it. The idea is spreading like a virus. And all the infrastructure and industry and businesses and everything are getting built to lower those costs of claiming one's monetary sovereignty. So, you know, that's like, why hire Bitcoin? You know, Clayton Christensen, a marketing professor at Harvard, he was like, why hire a milkshake? And like, what good or service are you hiring the milkshake to perform for you? And with Bitcoin, I laid out the 7 network effect thesis years ago. And that first network effect thesis is the monetary sovereignty and the potential price appreciation, the speculation that comes from that. And then we have so many others, you know, transfer of value, using it in daily transactions with Lightning Network or other stuff, the extensibility, smart contracts, proof of existence, you know, all different types of ways we can do it. But that 7th network effect, the final one, is world reserve settlement currency. And it's a very long, drawn out, protracted war to get monetary sovereignty and to go from, you know, a sub-million-dollar market cap when I first started talking about Bitcoin to multi-trillion-dollar market cap, world reserve settlement currency. There's just so much that has to be done, so much human action that has to take place, so many individual choices, so many businesses that get built, all this type of stuff. And surprisingly, it's happening faster than I thought it would, which is very good. In my opinion, you know, the more people that claim their monetary sovereignty, the better off this planet is going to be.
Christine Lagarde took over the ECB this week. I watched her press conference today. She mentioned the possibility of a European central bank digital currency. What do you think about central bank digital currencies? Oxymoron?
Why trust them? You know, because that's what we're talking about. Bitcoin is a new way to establish trust. It's decentralized, censorship resistant, and immutable. Like, nobody's rolling back the Bitcoin blockchain, and anybody can interact with it. Central bank digital currencies, why are they interesting?
If anything, it's a sign of weakness from them that they want to get in that game.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sign of weakness saying that, like, you know, we have a competitor on the scene, so we better try to at least compete with it. Okay, well, how are you going to compete with it? Like, yours is not limited in amount. Your emission schedule is determined behind closed doors. It's closed source. Not anybody can interact with it. They're going to want to layer additional political tools on top of it, like AML, KYC, all this stuff. Like, why trust that? Why use that? I mean, it's just another. There's as they said in the Senate hearings. There's Bitcoin, and then there's like garbage coin, right? And so these central bank digital currencies, like, why trust them? You know, they central banks are just political institutions attempting to carry out political means and goals. And so this fight over monetary sovereignty is about whether the people will have control of their lives and their money themselves, or whether it'll be controlled by political and financial elites. You know, Eurocoin or Federal Reserve coin or China coin, like, they could just freeze your account or just seize your funds. None of that's happening with Bitcoin, you know? So, I just don't really see how or why their altcoin scams are going to be able to compete against Bitcoin. Like, why trust their coins? Why trust their emission schedules? their emission schedules. How are their emission schedules going to get to a stock to flow ratio similar to Bitcoin's over the same time period? You know, because 4 years after, we have a halving in less than 6 months, you know, 150 days or so, and then we're going to have another halving 4 years after that. How are they going to have a stock to flow ratio anywhere close to Bitcoin's? So I just don't, I mean, they're not even going to be able to compete on the first network effect. What makes you think that they're going to be able to compete because of the other network effects that are there? The first network effect is the most important one.
In case the listener was curious, Trace was being very polite by calling it garbage coin, though that was very funny, that distinction that the congressman made there. There's Bitcoin. There's everything else, basically. So we're getting close to the end of the year here. Do you have any other predictions for 2020?
Well, for 2020, we have the halving happening, which is going to constrain the supply of saleable Bitcoin. And what I'm really interested to watch is the Plan B's Bitcoin price model based on scarcity. And because we have a co-integrated statistical relationship on the price. And so his model predicts that Bitcoin will hit $100,000 sometime before the December 31st of 2021. So I'm definitely got my eye on that model, especially because it's co-integrated. So people who are not familiar with that, I'd highly recommend you get yourself familiar with the statistical concept of co-integration and then why this could be so important. Because, I mean, even the large German bank Bayerin, they put out an 8-page report all about this stock-to-flow model and the Bitcoin price prediction. Because if we see $100,000 Bitcoin within the next 18 to 24 months, that's a whole new world in terms of market cap and things that we're able to do with Bitcoin. And in terms of the fundamentals, we've seen so many of the network effects being built out in companies and professionals and regulators and legislators, like working on all of this stuff, you know, the laws that Caitlin and I and everybody else has gotten passed in Wyoming, the special purpose depository bank that can be formed, the trading of the futures and options with Bakkt and Ledger X and the others, you know, so there's just so much infrastructure there now. That huge amounts of capital can come into this space. And so I'm just very interested in this stock to flow ratio and the pricing model for Bitcoin based on the stock to flow model. And so I'm watching that, and it would not surprise me if that stock to flow model continues to hold, because, you know, sure, it's not 100% guaranteed, but that co-integration is based on billions of trades by millions of individuals. What knowledge has been pulled out of the market as a result of all of those trades? You know, that's the implications of this. And so I'm super interested to see whether that model will hold or whether it's going to get falsified by not hitting that price target.
And if it does get falsified?
Well, then we have to go back and adjust our model. I mean, that's what, like, it, your mind has to be open, kind of like a parachute, in order to work. We can't be dogmatic, especially, you know, the scarcity is one forefront in the war for monetary sovereignty, but privacy, anonymity, fungibility, that's an entirely different front, kind of like Europe and the Pacific theater. And, you know, the privacy is going to be on a wide scale or continuum, and there are going to be lots of different solutions that come out, whether it's Monero, ring signatures, side chains with Mimblewimble, Mimblewimble in the base layer like Grin or Beam or Mimblewimble coin, things like Zcash. You're not going to be able to be dogmatic. You're going to have to figure out what of all the available tools is going to work for you. And I think it's the same way with the pricing model on Bitcoin itself. You know, adjust your model, adjust your behavior as new information and new technology comes on the scene, and use what you think is best for you. And in that process, of using and applying one's knowledge in the price discovery process, we're going to pull out a lot of knowledge, and we're going to get funded the projects that are really going to be helpful and sustainable over the long term. So, you know, this is very important in my opinion, all of these things. And so, you know, just don't be dogmatic. You need to keep an open and a flexible mind, and be assimilating all the newest information that's really high quality.
Trace, this is really great. You have any closing thoughts?
Well, just thanks so much for having me. You know, people can find me at the Bitcoin Knowledge Podcast, bitcoin.kn, on Twitter at Trace Mayer. And, you know, this is a public service announcement about proof of keys. So proofofkeys.com. Claim your monetary sovereignty. Don't just be some weak, spineless slave that's depending on someone else to run a full node and tell you what a Bitcoin is or hold your private keys. Like, stand up. Be the king or queen over your monetary fortress and your monetary castle and demand your Bitcoins and your other crypto assets. You know, that's how you really protect and defend yourself from these nefarious actors that are out there that are just trying to confiscate your wealth like vampires.
The website is proofofkeys.com. You can signal it on Twitter and elsewhere. And definitely, as Trace said, declare your monetary sovereignty on January 3rd. Our guest has been Trace Mayer. Trace, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much, Trace. It was very good talking to you once again.
Thanks so much for having me and supporting the public service initiative of Proof of Keys.